Hello, you're listening to Siren Radio. This is Word Perfect, and we're going to be joined today by our wonderful guest, Rhys Hughes, where we talk to him about all things writing and his process and his journey so far in becoming the incredible writer that he already is. So welcome to the show, Rhys.
Thank you very much.
It's exciting to talk to you. Rhys has recently published a book with Impspired and also been on a really interesting hike, so I'm hoping we're going to get to ask some questions about that as we go through this show as well. So Rhys, for those people at home who are not familiar with yourself yet, just give us a little introduction to who you are.
Well, I think probably most people are not at all familiar with me. I'm quite obscure. I've been writing for a long time, 30 years. I'm one of those writers who has a tiny little corner of the writing world with a few kind of devoted readers who buy everything that I do. And then the rest of the writing world completely ignores me. I think there's probably quite a few of us like this. You want to know when I started writing? I've been writing as a hobby from a young age. Earlier, you said to me that there's different people have different stories about how they first began writing. Some people have been, you said, academics all their lives, and then they start writing at a late age. Other people start when they were 6 years old. I am one of those who started when they were 6 years old, and I was 6 years old. And what I wanted to do was write. I used to watch films. I loved watching fantasy films. And I wanted to write my own versions of that because there weren't enough on television at the time to satisfy my desire. There would be things like the Jules Verne adaptations, The Valley of Guanji, King Kong, all that kind of stuff. I wanted more of it. And in those days, you know, the three channels on the television only kind of thing. I wanted to create my own stories because there weren't enough stories there available at the time. So I would try and write novels based on adventures, monsters mostly. And my novels would, you know, peter out after about five pages. But that's how I started. It never occurred to me to write short stories or anything short. I always thought that writing had to be full-length novels. And I did that from the age of six and never finished anything up until about the age of 10 when I finally decided that maybe short stories was a good idea. But again, I would start writing them without finishing them. I had hundreds and hundreds of beginnings of short stories, but nothing completed. I think I managed then to write, actually finish a short story when I was about 11 years old. And then another one, but I don't know. It seemed to be more satisfying to begin new works than to actually finish them. And that was always a problem for me when I was younger. Something that it took me quite a long time to get over was the fact that I would start, have a flying start, really, really enjoy it at the beginning, but sort of kind of lose enthusiasm when it came to concluding the thing. That's how it was for me. So I ended up with a lot of kind of fragments. All of that disappeared now, of course.
I think that's quite a common thing when I teach creative writing, especially for younger people. I call it the magpie effect, and it affects me as well. And that's that the new idea is always infinitely more shiny and exciting than the Absolutely. Thing you've already started. And so you get so, and even I'm guilty of it now. I must have 20 something part written plays where my new idea is just so much better than the one that I've already been working on for months that I just start the new one and never quite. And then over time, I might eventually go back to try and work on one of those old ideas a little bit more, but new things are always more exciting, aren't they?
Absolutely, exactly. And I have dozens, hundreds of fragments. But the way I found around that seemed to work for me was to start combining some of those fragments, have maybe a frame, and then have the kind of develop the fragments within the frame, or have the fragments as subsections of a longer work, or even combine them in kind of meld them into one text. So you have two or three things going on at the same time, and then create connections between them. That seemed to work for me. I would like kind of go along and vacuum up all these bits of beginnings and bits of kind of middles. And I kind of create a structure around them afterwards. And in some ways that was kind of helped me to push my imagination in the more lateral direction. Mm. Because if you have two things that are completely unconnected, you have to create a connection between them.
Well, you've become quite an expert at that as well, because when you look at, especially the book that we're gonna talk about shortly, your play on words and your ability to take what seems to be one idea and turn it into something completely different, is there, and that potentially has come from that need to try and make something out of a fragment of something else, I suppose.
Oh, I think it totally. But it was certain writers that I discovered later on who do that, that kind of changed my attitude to what was possible. So when I began kind of reading fiction seriously, when I was around about 12, 13, 14, I would read sort of basically the classics. It'd be Robert Louis Stevenson or H.G. Wells, or kind of very traditionally structured novels. And then when I discovered short story writers later on, like Edgar Allan Poe, they were, again, brilliant work, but very traditionally structured, planned. The works kind of evolve, and then they come to a definite end, and is, you know, the beginning, the middle, the end, exactly as recommended. But after that, I discovered writers who were able to do the fragmentary thing. Writers like Donald Barthelme, who was a really big influence on me. His work, you could see that he had had lots of ideas that had probably gone into notebooks. Then he decided to kind of use those ideas to actually kind of utilize them. And it wasn't necessary to develop an entire short story from one fragment and then develop another short story from another fragment. The fragments could actually be put together in one short story and actually connected in a way. The fact that they were non sequiturs didn't matter. Sometimes they were non sequiturs. It didn't matter because that was part of his style. That was part of the comedy. He used that to create a comic style where there was a constant surprises. And I am kind of fascinated and interested by the way that some writers use what are potentially disadvantages in their working methods or styles or just in their nature when it comes to writing, and turn that into a positive. I find that really interesting.
No, that's brilliant. It's always interesting to hear what inspires other people and what influences them, but not only the who and the what influences them, but how that's then influenced what you do. So which bits of that new part do you choose to take and use within your own stuff? So I think it's always interesting to hear that from different writers. So at the moment, in terms of your sort of current inspiration, then what are your focuses at the moment when you're picking up the pen?
Well, I've got back in during the lockdown last year. I got back into poetry, writing poetry. In fact, I didn't just get back into it. I actually have written more poems in the past year than I've written in the entirety of my previous life. And before that, I would only very occasionally write poems, maybe two a year. It wasn't a big thing, but for some reason, I started writing poems again last March 2020. And I pretty much decided that in the huge kind of field of poetry, I was going to occupy one little corner of that, and that was going to be the corner of offbeat, humorous poetry, a very small little niche-y kind of thing, but the thing that I felt most comfortable with, and the kind of style of poetry where I could be very spontaneous and write things very fast, and they could be very brief. They didn't have to be particularly long. They didn't have to be particularly deep in any way. If there are philosophical ideas in there, great, but it's not necessary. They can be controlled simply by wordplay, by a joke, by a pun, by some allusion, or just simply a quirky idea. And it came about, one of my favorite writers, Richard Brautigan, had read all his novels, I'd read all his short stories, and all I had left were his poems, which are not that easy to get hold of now. They're all out of print, but I managed to get hold of them. I've read pretty much everything he's written, apart from a few and collected pieces. And his poetry style was a big influence on me deciding that I was only going to concentrate on a particular type of poetry, that kind of offbeat, humorous kind of, some of Richard Brautigan's poems are not really, you wouldn't call them poems, they're kind of one-liners, but they're divided up in a particularly rhythmic way, or sometimes not even a rhythmic way, but the way that is kind of startling or a little bit, you read it and it surprises you, you know, an unusual metaphor, an unusual kind of rhythmic kind of an observation that's said in an unusual way that kind of makes you see it in a different light. Just very, very kind of simple, but somehow unique as well. So I started reading his poems, and then one day I sat down last March and wrote a poem. As I say, I only used to write about two poems a year. And then almost immediately afterwards, I wrote another one, and then another one. And every day I was doing this, and it was accelerating. I was writing 5, 6, 10, 20 poems a day, really short poems, you know. And I found that when I was out walking, hiking, or doing anything else, my subconscious brain started taking over and started writing these for me. And I would then have to either jot them down, try to remember them, and jot them down when I got home, although I'd often forget them. Or take a notebook out with me, which is what I started doing, or even just typing them on the phone and putting them on Facebook and then harvesting them later. It was almost as if my subconscious mind was doing it without my permission. Mm. It was just, take a phrase, take a word, an observation, anything, an idea, and just do write something, you know, about it. That tended to be quite silly, quite absurd, but quirky and hopefully nice. That was the important thing for me as well. Sort of the kind of thing that I hope would be maybe compared with somebody like Ivor Cutler, where they're quirky little ideas, and there's nothing there that is offensive. And you could say, okay, it's there's a certain kind of paucity of kind of significance when it comes to like politics or any kind of serious issue. But that's kind of not what it's about. I mean, there's so many great writers and great poets dealing with those subjects. I didn't feel that it was necessary for me to kind of add anything to that, because what I would add would be insufficient.
Well, I think your writing is great. I think if you chose to write on those subjects, you would probably write equally as well. But I do agree with what you said in terms of the especially the book that we're going to talk about shortly. I just don't think it needs those things. It is a great thing in itself, that it is just this sort of concise, just play on words and play on ideas, and it's a really nice is a difficult word for me to use, because sometimes when you say something's nice, it feels a little bit like you're playing it down, or you're making it into something sound like, oh, that's, you know, that's nice, that's twee. But it's not that. It is just a nice book. It's just nice to read. Everything flows together, you know, in a way that just fits. Like you say, everything's kept short. There's no real long, deep, you know, thing there. It's just this nice book to pick up and flick through. So I think you've achieved your aim.
Thank you very much. That's
In terms of, so people at home might say, well, I mean, you said it yourself, in terms of people might not know who you are. I think probably more people know who you are than even you're aware of. And the fact that you've managed to gather a loyal following who will buy the books you bring out, you're already 10 steps ahead of lots of us. So I congratulate you on having a loyal following, however large that loyal following is. But for those people sitting at home, have you got anything that you could share with us now?
Oh, I could read a poem one of the poems that I wrote last year. I've just been saying that most of the poems that I wrote last year are very, very short, but there were some that were a little bit longer. Still not long, but a little bit longer than that. So I can read one of those.
Yes, that'd be perfect.
And this poem has a very specific origin, which comes from when I was young, and in school assembly, we had to sing hymns. And there was a famous hymn, "There is a green hill far away without a city wall." And of course, without in that hymn is the old sense of the word without, which means outside. But nobody explained that to me. So for me, without meant it didn't have a city wall. There's a green hill without a city wall. And I remember thinking when I was little, what's unusual about that? Most green hills don't have city walls.
Yeah.
So the poem is about that, and it's called Without. There is a green hill far away without a city wall. Yes, but most hills don't have city walls. That's like saying there is an aardvark close at hand without a degree in economics, or there is a flapjack on the plate without the keys to the palace gate. Or there is a cumulus high above without a clue about love. There is a musket on the wall without any interest in football. There is a bassoon in the music room without aspirations to be the next president of the Board of Trade. There is a spade stuck in the soil without the skills to boil yams or wheel prams or construct dams on the rivers of anywhere at all. Or there is a biscuit in a tin without a workable dorsal fin. Or there is a smart comparison in a military garrison without a clue about what to do during a war. Or there is a flute made from a root without a suit to wear at dinner. Or there is a sinner on the roof without a halo that he can dip in tea. Or there is an office that deals with information without a pangolin from the Haitian nation working there. Or there is a mayor on the stairs without an ability to hypnotize bears. I don't wish to express too much indignation, but the green hill in that song doesn't seem quite so remarkable to me. There is a reader outside the page who feels little or no rage at the missing city wall that the green hill never had. It's sad that I feel your rage instead. And that's it.
Very good. Very
Thank
good.
You.
Nice. And it's actually a great example because that is the rhythm and the pace that I hear you're writing at, or quite a lot of the poems in the book. And it's always interesting for me to hear you read yourself, because obviously I receive stuff by email. I read it on the page. I put my own then take on how I think that you would sound that poem. So it's great to hear it in your voice and in your tone. And yeah, that was a great piece. Some brilliant examples in that.
Thank you very much.
We come to our first sort of musical break in the show. And as always on Word Perfect, we asked our guests to select some of the musical tracks. So the first track we're going to play today is Transglobal Underground, Delta Disco. So tell us a little bit about why you've picked that track, Rhys.
Transglobal Underground, for me, evoke the kind of heady days of festivals in the 1990s, when music changed. Obviously, the music in the 1980s was very electronic and very kind of purely Western oriented. But in the 90s, other influences started to creep in. First of all, you had kind of normal kind of dance music that was kind of techno, that was just for people to go clubbing to. But some of these musicians started to bring in influences from other cultures. This had already been happening in an underground way, but we weren't really aware of it then before we knew about the internet. To get these kinds of records, you had to go to really obscure record shops. But in the 90s, it all kind of broke open. And Transglobal Underground, to me, had that kind of something now that is a little bit derided, but it's still dear to my heart, internationalist, cosmopolitan mix of influences from everywhere, Africa, India, Latin America, you name it, and really great musicians. And it just reminds me of the fact that at the time in the late 90s, especially, there seemed to be real optimism for the future. There seemed to be real hope that the borders were going to break down and everyone was going to be, you know, this kind of like this dream of international brotherhood and sisterhood. And that's what they really evoke for me, that kind of optimism that sadly at the moment is gone.
Yeah, not quite got there yet, have we? No. Maybe one day. So this then is Transglobal Underground, Delta Disco.
Hipsters, flipsters, and finger-popping daddies, we give you the international trans-global conglomerate of music. Light another cigarette and hold me close. Egyptian pharaohs fell from The drummer's coming in so vicious, so mean. Let me tell you something about this scene. Yeah, you see, internationally and universally, we just taking jazz to a new height, to a new dimension, to another sphere. Yes, we're taking it where it's never been before. Not even Captain James Cook has ever been there. Pyramids and pharaohs, the River Nile is like a disco. The ebb and the flow, the ebb and the flow, the ebb and the flow and you go, and you go with the main beat. Finger popping daddies. Coming strong. Now make the drums 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 coming strong. Make the drums coming strong. Make the drums coming strong.
Welcome back. You're listening to Word Perfect. This is Siren Radio. We're joined today on Word Perfect by Rhys Hughes. You were just listening there to Transglobal Underground Delta Disco. We were talking just before the musical break there to Rhys about a lot of his inspirations and where his sort of writing process has come from. But I want now, Rhys, for us to talk a little bit more about the book that's about to come out through Inspired. So tell us a little bit about the book in itself.
So as I said before, I never really wrote much poetry until last year, and last year the kind of the floodgates opened and I started writing lots of poems, and they tended to be short poems. They tended to be humorous poems that were kind of based more on the logic of word association than empirical logic, so wordplay, puns, but also offbeat kind of connections between phrases, images, ideas that form the core of the poems. There's nothing in there that is kind of traditional, kind of narrative in any way. And I just kept writing them. And eventually I thought, well, I have enough now for a collection. And I put them all together in a big document, and there was lots of them. And I went through the document and I erased ones that I thought perhaps were weaker. And I was still left with a lot of poems, but it seemed to me to be a decent length for a book. And that's when I submitted it. And I'm very, very, very delighted to find that it was accepted. It's something that I'm quite excited about and pleased about, because it's we're living through times, I mean, without exaggerating, we're living through times that are not easy for people, and not easy in terms of economics, politics, health, even all sorts of things. And this is something that a book that I feel contributes just a tiny bit to a positive outlook. The poems are humorous and upbeat and offbeat. And the idea is that they are, I mean, it's a drop in the ocean. Of course it is. But it seems to be that it's my contribution anyway for this work. And that's how it came about, really. It really was just all these poems that I'd written very, very spontaneously, all put together in one book. And I think that the individual poems kind of support each other, and that although I like the individual poems in themselves very much, the actual finished book feels that it is somehow more integrated, as if it was planned that way, but it wasn't. Mm-hmm. So it grew organically, but still seems to have some kind of internal structure where little separate poems support each other. And it could be because many of the kind of concerns that I had with finding offbeat ideas are quite similar in different ways to each other. The patterns, the forms of the poems are similar, even if the content isn't.
Mm. Yeah, there is a cohesion to the book, definitely. Like I say, it doesn't feel like a random collection of pieces that were sort of scattered from all over. It does feel very much like they belong next to each other, and they belong in that book. So where did the title for the book come from? So Bunny Q and Others, where has that come from?
I just I wrote a poem called Bunny Q, which was one of those poems that has what's it called when it's words are like pictures. It's not poetry concrete, is it?
Yeah, it to an extent. Yeah, I don't think it's not quite that, because the words don't, they're not words that form an image. But I think it is that kind of idea of concrete poetry, isn't it? That particular piece where the punctuation creates an image, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. So you can create a little figure of a rabbit using punctuation marks. So I did that, but it occurred to me then if I had a big line of these, it looked like they were rabbits queuing. They had to be queuing for something. So I was looking for the symbol for a glass of wine. And I used the symbol for the glass of wine. So it looked like they were rabbits queuing for wine on a buffet. And it looked like a buffet table.
Yes.
But when I transferred the file to my other computer, the wine symbol changed into a little sun. Completely changed it. So I thought, well, I have to use this. This whatever happens, I think you can use in a different way. So I wrote the poem about how the rabbits were hoping to queue for wine, but there were only suns available. Mm-hmm. And that's to do with the way things are written and the punctuation. I made that part of the poem. I just liked then the title of that poem as a title for the collection. I mean, obviously the collection has to have a title. It is nice when the collection has a title all to itself that kind of encapsulates the book itself. But I felt that this kind of did that as well as being a title of an individual poem.
Mm. It's an interesting, and the cover looks great as well. So I think
I think the cover is fantastic. And all the poems in this book are short, and they feel like they are queuing. They feel like they are little rabbits in a way, and they're all queuing for something. Queuing for the reader's attention, perhaps, or the reader's hopefully for the reader's appreciation.
Mm, no, that's brilliant. And it's not the only book that you're going to have out this summer, is it? So you've had a successful few months.
I have four books coming out this summer, and three are out already, and this one will be the fourth. Just purely coincidental that they've all come out at the same time, because they've been written over a period of several years. So one of them, another one of these books is about rabbits. it's nothing. You know, I don't have an obsession with rabbits or anything. It's just, again, that's just a coincidence. It's a novella called "My Rabbit's Shadow Looks Like a Hand," which is a title I've wanted to use for a long time. I have a book in which I write down potential titles for stories. This title I wrote down 15 years ago, and I couldn't find a story for it until about 3 years ago. I had this idea of this man who has a rabbit, and the light, he has a torch, and he shines the torch on the rabbit, and it casts a shadow. And of course, when we make rabbits with our hands, shadow rabbits, this is like an inverse of that. Mm. So his rabbit looked like a human hand, and the rabbit's eating a carrot, and the human hand on the wall looks like it's holding a pen. So what he does is he puts a piece of paper next to the shadow pen, goes to bed. In the morning when he wakes up, there's text written. The shadow hand, which is the shadow of his rabbit, has written a text on the paper. And he does this every night for 12 nights. And some of the texts are poems, some of the short stories, and they're all sort of connected. The way that he has the torch held against the rabbit at greater distance, if the bulb starts flickering or whatever, produces a different text. So I've used it as an excuse for a picaresque novella, which has that as a framing device, and then has 12 separate sections that are self-contained poems or short stories, but are connected as well.
Mm.
And as I was saying earlier, this is my solution to the fact that I tend to prefer to write fragments rather than long, rolling texts. I've tried to find a way of connecting these fragments, and the framing device is very important, and the picaresque framing device particularly.
Yeah, and I think that sounds great. Definitely will have to go onto my list of books that I need to get. So if people are at home and they want to get hold of yourself or some more of your work, where could they go to find you?
Well, Amazon obviously has taken over the book buying world. Unfortunately or fortunately, however you feel about that. Most of my books are on Amazon, but I think most of them can also be bought directly from the publisher. So one of the other of the four books I've had published this summer is A Weird Western, which was published in Canada, and that's only available from Amazon. You can't buy that from the publisher direct. But the rabbit novella can be bought from the publisher, who are Ibenvale Books, and they produce really amazingly beautiful designs, covers, the internal design of the books. Everything about them is so really, really nice. I'm a big fan of Ibenvale Books. And then the other book I've had published this summer is another novella published by Elsewhen Press, and they're another one of my favorite publishers. They are just so nice to their authors. They're just really, really, really good, really professional. This is a novella set in Africa, and again, it's another fragmentary type thing with a framing device. It's about a professor who's forced to teach a subject he doesn't want to teach. He's forced to teach himself to his students. And so he sets his students a task of writing an essay about how they think he spends his free time. And they don't know how he spends his free time, so they have to kind of imagine. And the novella is these 18 essays written by his students that see how he spends his free time from different perspectives. And they get it partly right, but not fully right. All of the essays get it partly right, but not fully right. But combined, the picture is exactly what he does in his free time. There is, it's like a jigsaw. These 18 pieces only have part of the truth. That's another one I'm quite pleased with. So I have to say, it's been a pretty good year for me in publishing terms.
Mm, yeah, that's fantastic. And you do have a blog as well, don't you, that people could check out the books so they could find the links if they need them to get these, which is resaurus.blogspot.com, which is resaurus.blogspot.com. So if you want to check out some more of Reese's work, then you can go to there and you'll find the links to the books that he's just talked about, which all sound interesting in their own right. So definitely worth checking out Reese Hughes if you can. For his latest book, Bunny Q and Others, you can find that by either going to Amazon, as Reese mentioned, or you can go to impspired.com. So that book comes out on the 1st of August, and you'll be able to find him either on the author section, the homepage of our website, or you'll be able to go directly to Amazon to pick up that book there as well. So best of luck, Reese, for all of the publications that are coming out. They all sound great, so I hope you get the response that you deserve for them. Do you have maybe another reading that we could have just before we sort of come towards the end of today's show?
Absolutely. I have another poem. This is, as I said, I used to write very few poems, but I would write maybe two a year. And this is one I wrote probably about 20 years ago. I can't remember exactly. It's called The Bones of Jones. The bones of Jones lie under the sea. I'm a teapot, claims a femur. I am a flute, insists a knuckle. We have degrees in economics, sing the ribs. I'm the smell of parsley, declares a tibia. It's nice and dry down here, observes an ankle. The only bone of Jones that doesn't lie under the sea is the pelvis. I knew the Duchess of Cumberland, it says. And that's it.
Wow, the play on words is great. I do love that. And I especially love it when I'm listening to something and it takes me a moment to get the play on words.
It's literally, it just came from that first line, the bones of Jones lie under the sea. And then it occurred to me that lie, is tell lies. So I had to write about all the individual bones. And I know nothing about anatomy, so I had to go on to the encyclopedia and find out the names of the bones. And then I had to construct lies, lies, what the kinds of things they would say. There's a bit of a Dylan Thomas thing in there with I'm the smell of parsley. Comes from under Milk Wood, one of the ghosts who was one of the sailors that worked with sailed with Captain Cat asks Captain Cat, what's the smell of parsley? Because he can no longer remember. So it comes from that partly.
Amazing. No, that's brilliant. So you've got these four books that have just come out. You found in this last sort of 12, 18 months, this sort of newfound splurge of poetry writing. What's next for you now? Do you already have your next project planned or?
I'm always writing short stories all the time. And what I'm trying to do is if I open my computer, I will have maybe 50 fragmentary short stories. And what I'm trying to do is get that down to a normal number, the kind of normal number that the normal author would have on the go at the same time, two or three. It's the same with reading books. I was for a long time reading 10 books at the same time. I decided to get that down, and I've managed to get it down to five. I want to get it down to maybe two or three. It's normal. Same with coffee. I would be drinking 10 cups of coffee a day. Now I'm down to two or three. I think this is good. It's manageable. It means that what you're doing when it comes to writing and reading feels less like a chore or less like work, and it feels more like the way it should be, which is a pleasure and a creative endeavor that gives you satisfaction without stress. So I'm working lots and lots of short stories, and I'm trying to finish them and get them down. I'm writing lots of novellas, and I'm going to finish these. When I've done that next year, I'm going to go back to novels because I have a novel that I started in 1994 that's only half done. And I have another novel that I started in 1998, which is two thirds done. I have another novel that I started a few years later that's about three quarters done. I'd like to finish those. I started a few years ago, I started writing short plays, and I found it incredibly enjoyable. But I've only had, and I've written so far, I've written 22 one-act plays, but I've only had three published. And what I would dearly love to do, and I probably write another one this year, and that, or maybe another two. I would dearly love to have one performed one day, either as a radio play or in some way. That's my kind of ambition really now, but I have no idea how to do that. I have a friend who's a part of an amateur dramatics group in Leeds. I'm going to write a play for him. I've been saying this for a couple of years. I haven't done it yet, but that's one I'm going to do. They're very short plays that are kind of have very minimal sets and minimal characters. So I'm going to look for anyone who knows about the theatre, like yourself, for advice on what I can do with these.
Yeah, more than happy to take a look and give you some advice if I'm able to. Yeah.
I would love to send you some.
Yeah, no, that sounds brilliant. And if for no other reason, then I get to read them. And that's a good thing for me. So I'm quite excited myself. Tomorrow, I actually go back into rehearsal for a play that's now on its about fifth attempt to get going. Every time we've started, we've either lost a cast member or COVID's kicked in, or various other, you know, lockdowns, various lockdowns have stopped us from getting started again. So I'm excited that we're finally getting back to a point where we can start to get those things going. So it's it'd be great to read some of your plays. And if they're anything like the work of yours that I've read so far, then I'm sure they are absolutely brilliant as well. So thank you very much for joining us today, Rhys. It's been great to talk to you. Great to find out a little bit more about yourself and your writing. As always, we play out with songs on the show, and the final song for us today has been picked by Rhys. So, like I say, once more, just thank you very much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Dance our way out of our constriction. Gonna be freaking up and down the hang up alleyway. With the groove I only got, we shall all be moved. Ready or not, yeah.
One nation
under a
We'll be right back.